The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeba.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we were played in there with a blast of Amara Terra singing, well, playing Cozzi, their trademark tune, or our trademark tune from the Giro. That is a flavour of our Giro coverage. Did that transport you back to May, chaps, and Italian squares drinking whipped cream mochaccinos?
Not exactly. Do they blast? Do they blast Amara Terra?
I think so.
They serenade us, don't they?
Yeah, but there's a lot of energy.
They serenade us back to Italy. Oh, okay.
It's quite an aggressive foot stomping tune, that one, though, isn't it? I mean, I think a blast is a fairly accurate description, Rich. It doesn't just transport
Thank you,
me back to Italy in May; it transports me forward to Italy in May 2019. Now only, what, 6 months and a bit away.
It also transports me forward 10 days to the Clapham Grand Theatre in South London, because they will be playing at our sold-out show there, which we're really looking forward to, and welcoming 500 or so of you listeners to our show with guests. We've got various guests joining us, some regulars, some special guests, all to be revealed on the night. We're really looking forward to that. But yeah, we thought we'd give you a flavour of the Giro to start this episode, just because the main topic of conversation this week, or one of the topics of conversation this week, is the presentation of the Giro route today. We're speaking on Wednesday. On which,
Rich, we thought a few months ago that the 2019 Giro route would feature a heavy helping of Amara Terra's home region, Puglia. But it's not. We're going to make one short incursion into Puglia on the day when we go to San Giovanni Rotondo, which is a pretty unpleasant place full of religious tact.
Anyway, wow, you're really selling it. Is it like Lourdes? Is it the Italian Lourdes?
I've actually never been, but so that's a bit of an ill-informed comment, but I know what it's likely to be like because it's closely associated with, I don't know, is it the birthplace of Padre Pio, who is an Italian religious icon? And yeah, I expect they will be very reminiscent of Lord Napalm.
Excellent.
Also in this episode, we're gonna discuss a couple of things that slipped through the net a little bit last week. That's the move by the Tour de France, or the noises made by the Tour de France to ban power meters. Talk briefly about that later on. We'll also hear from Andy Fenn, the Aqua Blue sport writer, who is struggling to find a new team. And we've got a little update on the Aqua Blue situation. And we'll also, in our final part, turn our attention to track racing. And we'll hear from Sir Chris Hoy and Callum Skinner on some of the changes in track sprinting in particular. So Daniel may well have disappeared by then, but can you give us a news roundup before all of that, Lionel?
I can indeed, Rich. Yeah, and we'll start on the track, indoor cycling. The Track World Cup went to Milton in Canada after kicking off in Paris a little while ago. And it was a good weekend for the British, and in particular for the Kenny family. Laura Kenny, racing in her first World Cup since January 2016. She did the Olympics, of course, in 2016, but this was really her return to top-level international track racing since the birth of her son, the son that she and Jason Kenny had, Albie. Laura Kenny won the Omnium and was also in the Team Pursuit squad, which beat Italy. Katie Archibald was in that Team Pursuit squad as well, and then she teamed up with Eleanor Barker to win the Madison. Jason Kenny won the Keirin, and there was a really impressive performance by the Hoob Watt Bike test team, who topped qualification, beating Great Britain in the qualifying round and made their way all the way through to the final and lost out to Denmark. And their lineup includes John Archibald, who is Katie's brother. The other riders in the team were Harry Tanfield, Daniel Bigham and Jonathan Wales. So it's a funny old year, this one, isn't it? Kind of midway through the Olympic cycle. Of course, you know, there's the rest of this season and then next season and then into the Olympics in Tokyo. So this is the point where it starts to kind of build up again towards the Olympic Games. So no doubt when the Track World Cup resumes in Berlin, we'll probably see everyone just raising the bar just that little bit more as they head towards the World Championships next year. Something else that slipped through the net last week while we focused on the Tour de France route launch was the suggestion that 1999 Paris-Roubaix winner Andrea Taffy intends to make a comeback. He's looking for a team who will take him on and give him the opportunity to race Paris-Roubaix 20 years after he won it as a 32-year-old. He'll be 52 in April, I think. That Paris-Roubaix...
I once raced against Andrea Taffy. I'm sure he'll remember it well.
1998, Tour of Langkawi. I was about to say, Rich.
Tour of Langkawi in 1998.
Who could forget?
Well, I'm sure he won't forget. I almost caused a crash one day staring at his calves. almost rode right into the back of him. Wow, staring.
Who finished best?
Oh, goodness me. It's quite a long time ago now, Lionel. 20 years.
Did Giuliano Figueras win that race? I'm not looking to.
I can't remember. I don't know.
I think I remember.
I don't
that.
Know.
Anyway.
I didn't win it. And I think Taffy maybe had the edge there.
Well, he certainly had the edge in Paris-Roubaix in 1999. He had several... he had a few problems in the race. He was in groups that were well off the front of the race, and he launched several attacks and won it by more than 2 minutes. It helped, of course, that he had three Mapei teammates in the group behind, Wilfried Peters, Tom Steels and Johan Mizeo, but nevertheless it was...
Hang on, is this a 1999 news roundup?
It is, yeah. But what's... just in a line, what's your hot take on this? Andrea Taffy attempting to come back at the age of 52. He's registered for the UCI's testing pool, so he would be eligible to... ride Paris-Roubaix. He's looking for one of the teams that might get a wild card to take him on. Publicity stunt, obviously.
Well, look, if Pozzato's still riding, then, you know.
Well,
no, Pozzato actually might not be riding. I think he might be retiring, which would be tragic. Oh, and we'll obviously dedicate a 6-episode special series to that. Taffy, I cannot imagine that he will get a team. He claims to be in contact with several who are likely to get invitations to Paris-Roubaix if they're not already qualified. Can you imagine that anyone would offer him a contract?
Sadly, I can. And the sadness of that is, as we'll hear from Andy Fenn, you know, there are a lot of young riders in their prime who are struggling to get a contract. But you can imagine that a team would take him on, can't you? Because it will bring a lot of publicity, and that's what it's all about, isn't it? And physically, could he do it? I don't know what sort of shape he's in, but he probably—I don't know—he probably—he obviously feels that he can. And on the one hand, I sort of applaud it because, you know, setting a great example for 50-somethings everywhere. Not that any of us are 50-something yet, but that's got to be a good thing. But on the other hand, you feel that there are probably riders more deserving of a contract than a 52-year-old retired Italian great, as he is.
Indeed. Well, we shall wait and see whether somebody takes him on. Returning to the news roundup, we've heard that Victor Campenaerts is going to tackle Bradley Wiggins' hour record, probably in Mexico. In 2019, he's planning to train for this attempt in the warmth and altitude in Namibia. He needs to beat 54.526 kilometres. That was the mark that Wiggins set in June 2015. And, well, even at altitude, that's not a given, but we shall watch that with interest. There was a very sad bit of news, cycling-related news, relating to the plane crash in Indonesia this week. Former professional Andrea Manfredi, who raced for Bardiani CSF, was on board that flight which crashed, and unfortunately he was killed in that air accident. Another sad bit of news is that Norman Scheel died last week at the age of 86. Now, if you were following cycling in, you know, well, any period of time from the 50s through to the late 90s, Norman Scheel's name may be familiar to you. He was a world amateur pursuit champion, a Commonwealth Games champion. He rode the Tour de France, or 10 days of it at least, in 1960 for the Great Britain team. He was a very well-respected Great Britain coach, and then he moved to Canada, coached the Canadian national team, and among the riders he coached were Steve Bauer, of course, who went on to wear the yellow jersey at the Tour de France, and Gordon Singleton, the track sprinter who won Canada's first world title. And the reason I remember the name was because when I first started working at Cycling Weekly, he won the points race in the over 65s category at the World Masters in Manchester in 1998. So sort of towering figure, really, in you know, for several generations of British but also Canadian cycling. He passed away aged 86. A bit later on we'll talk about Aqua Blue Sport. I've got a little bit to update on what is going on with their team, which I will bring up when we hear from Andy Fenn later.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa, for their continued support. And I haven't had my Explore jacket yet that I put out a call for last week, but I'm sure it's in the post. Very nice, some very nice Explore clothing from Rafa. And even me, if I keep saying that word, Lionel, you're still not going to tease out this new series.
Well... No, well, you've more
nothing.
You're certainly exploring every possible avenue to get free stuff. That's for sure.
Ah, hey. Anyway, the Giro route was announced this afternoon. Giro 2019 route. Daniel, I'm sure you were glued to the presentation. What do you make of it? You've sent us a very nice graphic, which shows us the whole race, and it really what it illustrates is just how backloaded it is with the mountains coming in the second half of the race and towards the end. This is a pattern that we've seen the last few years, of course. It begins in Bologna, as we knew, with a short time trial, not a prologue, but a short time trial. And then it finishes in Verona with a time trial. I love the fact with the Giro that it moves around. It was the last time the Giro finished in Verona, 2010. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, with a similar length of time trial. So that'll be nice. That'll be a nice place to finish, won't it? And quite accessible, which is nice as well. What are your thoughts on it, Daniel? Three time trials, not a huge distance in terms of time trialing, a lot of climbing as you'd expect.
Yeah, in sort of football cliched parlance, it's game of two halves, as you said, Rich. A few things that stand out: 58 kilometers of time trialing, which sounds like quite a lot. It's more than the Tour de France. However, when you zoom in and look more closely at the time trials, the first one in Bologna is almost prologue length, but it's also finishes with the climb to the Madonna di San Luca, which is a very steep climb, 2 kilometer climb. So that's an unusual one. Then the next time trial on ninth stage to San Marino also finishes with quite a long climb. It's not necessarily a route for the specialists. And then the final time trial in Verona, it's only 15 kilometers, and it's also it goes over a relatively significant climb. So again, not one for the big roulers. So I think the climbers will be the ones who are sort of fluttering their eyelashes at RCS and suggesting that they might be partial to having a go at this Giro. The first week, you know, last year I remember we talked about, we kind of bemoaned the fact that the in this generation of riders, or certainly the riders that were at the Giro last year, we didn't have the glut of the sort of punchers, the scattisti, the guys who go well on the short, sharp climbs, which are a real feature of the Giro. Particularly in the first week. It's the same again this year. There are a lot of stages where guys who can climb but are sort of explosive on short, steep climbs could do pretty well. But there's also plenty of flat terrain for the sprinters. But then from stage 12, it's really, well, it's pretty much all mountains. Not particularly high mountains. The race does go over the Gavia, which is 2,600 meters, and there is a very exciting new summit finish at a place called Lago Cerú, which is sort of three quarters of the way up the Colle del Nivole, which is one of the sort of high, very, very high passes in the Alps. The race has never been there before. But yeah, the Giro is not making such a big thing of the altitude of the climbs as the Tour is this year. But, you know, the usual steep climbs, relatively long climbs, and climbs that will definitely suit the pure climbers.
Chris Froome was at the presentation as the defending champion. Any hints as to, you know, who might be looking at the Giro? And I mean, we're really uncertain, aren't we? The last two winners, Dumoulin and Froome, you suspect are going to target the Tour de France this year. So who is likely to be making the Giro their number one focus, do you think?
Well, you chaps said last week that you thought Bernal should go to the Tour de France, didn't you, for Sky? I mean, I would suggest that with a climber-friendly route, and Thomas and Froome still both saying in the press and suggesting that they want to ride for the win at the Tour de France, I would say it's a perfect opportunity for Bernal to lead Sky. That would seem pretty obvious to me. Nibali has suggested that he's not going to ride the Tour de France and he'll focus on the Giro. And Dumoulin has indicated that he's more likely to target the Tour de France next year. But it's certainly a route that looks as though it will suit Dumoulin pretty well. I must confess, I listened to a rival podcast the other day, the controversial Lance Armstrong podcast, and there was a discussion on there about how to make racing less defensive in major tours from the point of view of the organiser. And the controversial Lance Armstrong himself suggested that there should be more kilometres of time trialling, so that, which would mean that the climbers, well, they have a big deficit after the time trials and they have to attack in the mountains from a long way out to gain time back. I kind of think that It's a false premise based on this misnomer that there is this clear line of demarcation between sprinters and climbers, that, you know, anyone who's under 5'8" and weighs less than 65 kilograms is automatically a climber. But when, if you analyse things, you know, for example, last year in the major tours, the best time trialists tend also to be the best climbers. Tom Dumoulin was certainly, you would say, in the top three or four climbers in the Giro last year. Same applies to the Tour de France. Same applies to Froome. Same applies to Thomas at the Tour de France. So, I mean, it strikes me that you will probably get the same outcome of the strongest riders and the strongest teams being able to control things in the mountains, whether you've had a lot of kilometres of time trialling before or have got a lot of kilometres of time trialling afterwards. What do you think?
Well, I think it's kind of nonsense, because it supposes that the climbers are just sitting in the group not attacking because they think they don't need to, whereas the reason they're sitting in the group not attacking from a long way out is because they don't feel they can, or because history in the last decade certainly tells us that they attack off the front They get close into the red or close to the red, and the group behind can just basically take its time to reel them back in. I mean, we have seen some long range attacks in recent years in the Tour and the Giro. I mean, the one that springs immediately to mind right now is Stephen Kruijswijk on the Alpe d'Huez stage. I mean, that looked really, really good for a while, but was always kind of doomed because he was just gradually ridden down. And I think if you have more time trialing kilometres and let the better time trialists, and as you say, Daniel, that the overlap between the best time trialists and the best climbers when it comes to the GC riders now is it's significant. All you basically do is make it harder for the climbers. Not you don't level the playing field by giving them more of the terrain that they're less good on.
And I think, you know, it is a fact that there's a clear correlation between the number of kilometres of time trialling and how close a race is. And, you know, the last few years we've seen an awful lot of very close major tours, and that's been due to the fact that the kilometres of time trialling have been very much reduced. You know, in the Tour de France, it was common to have over 100 kilometres of time trialling. Now we're well below 50, and consequently, you know, you're often getting tours that are still open on the final weekend, and you've got five riders within 2 minutes. But it always baffles me slightly that riders retire, and the moment that they retire, they seem to just assimilate or take on the kind of the viewpoint of the armchair quarterback, and everything they know about what you've just explained, Lionel, that the climbers simply can't attack when, you know, a strong team is setting the pace on the front, and you know, we've seen that with Sky in recent years. They seem to forget all of that instantly, and they kind of talk about racing in the way you would talk about a computer game.
I mean, the Miguel Indurain years surely prove that that premise is false as well, because you know, there were some good climbers around in his day, but there were also long time trials, and he gained such an advantage that, you know, they had no chance of getting it back. What would have made those tours more interesting perhaps would have been much, much shorter time trials, forcing Indurain, you know, out to attack when he didn't have to in the mountains. So,
when was this golden era of scintillating racing every single day? I mean, I think, objectively speaking, the last 10 years have yielded more interesting days of racing than almost at any point in the last 20 or 30 years, certainly, if not going further back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, when you consider the Giro in particular, I mean, the year that it was the three-way fight between Chavez, Kruijswijk and Nibali, and you know, Nibali really pulled off a bit of a heist, didn't he, at the end. And this year with Chris Froome's remarkable sort of Eddie Merckx-style long-range attack. I mean, if you, in 10 years' time, we may well look back at this as a sort of a golden age of sort of unpredictable attacking, suspenseful racing. And when you, Daniel, that graphic you sent us of the whole the profile of all the stages put together, and Richard made the point about how backloaded it is with all of the mountain stages, certainly in the last half of the race and mainly the last week and a bit, I think we're in for a very similar race as the last couple of years, where, you know, particularly 2016, where we thought this race isn't really getting going, is it? It's not, in from a GC point of view, it didn't really get going until the final week, and then the final week was quite a humdinger, and just at first glance it looks similar again.
Let's take a pause there, chaps, for a brief commercial break.
Few professional cyclists appreciate the history of cycling better than Sir Bradley Wiggins. In his new book, Icons, My Inspiration, My Motivation, My Obsession, Wiggins takes us on an incredible journey through the sport he loves, exploring the lives of 21 of cycling's greatest and most controversial figures, including Tom Simpson, Miguel Indurain, and Lance Armstrong. In so doing, Bradley shares for the first time key pieces from his never-before-seen collection of memorabilia and sheds new light on what the sport demands of its best competitors. Packed with great stories and beautifully presented in fully illustrated hardback, Icons is a fascinating homage to Wiggins' lifelong obsession with cycling. To find out who made Bradley's all-time 21, get your copy. Out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.
well, enough of this nonsense about bike racing. Daniel, what I want to know is the start in Bologna, a beautiful town, famous for the two towers, one of which is kind of short and leaning, and one of which is tall and proud. Famous for bolognese sauce?
Yeah, although it's more commonly known as just ragù in Bologna, but yeah, you're right, Lionel. Very famous for its cuisine in general. It's quite commonly heard view that Bologna has the best food in Italy, home of tortellini, cannelloni with bolognese sauce. So yeah, I'm sure you'll find everything you...
Well, what I do like is that it goes in a big loop from Bologna back to more or less Bologna, doesn't it, in the first 9 or 10 days. So, you know, double helpings of ragu. But are we going to have heated debates, Daniel, about the correct method of making a traditional ragu, what should be in it and what shouldn't? Because it's one of those things, one of those sauces that has been bastardised by the British, isn't it? I mean, I'm imagining you're going to have a field day with this.
I'm sure we'll be having those debates, Lionel. I'm sure we'll be having those debates. And actually, as you mentioned, that there's a wonderful organisation in, I think they're based in Bologna, and it's called something like the Confraternity of Italian Tortellini. And it's this extraordinary organisation which deliberates every, I think they meet every year or every 6 months, and discuss... Every time they meet, the same thing. What is the composition of the perfect tortellini? And this is the subject of great debate and consternation at times. Anyway, maybe we'll...
This year's Tiramisu World Cup extravaganza, where we tasted the rival tiramisu, what about a rest day challenge where we go to somewhere to make something, make some pasta or make some sauce, and you against me? What do you reckon?
But we've already discussed your... What concerns me about you and making pasta sauces in particular is not the way you make them. It's what you do with it once you've made it. It's the presentation.
Is this whether you just pour it on?
Yeah.
The etiquette, that's very important, isn't it?
Extremely important.
Well, I think we should decide this over some kind of challenge on the rest day. I'll leave it up to you. You can do some research and find somewhere where we can maybe go and make something. I'm sure there'll be a restaurant or some kind of sort of cookery school where we could go and do an hour.
Well, I think, Lionel, on the first stage, or sorry, the second stage after the time trial, we're going through the heartland of Parmigiano Reggiano Parmesan cheese, so that might be an opportunity for something, a little gastronomic detour, and then a couple of days later we're going to Frascati, home to some famous white wine. It's got a pretty bad reputation actually outside Italy, and the wine stage itself, I don't know if you've noticed, is stage 9, which goes into San Marino. But the wine being honoured that day is the Sangiovese, or the wine produced from the Sangiovese grape that's made in that region. And a bit of a left field choice, actually, for the wine stage. There were some more obvious candidates, I would have said, but it's all to do with sponsorship and cash, I think.
Can I just briefly drag the conversation kicking and screaming down back to cycling? To put a damner on things. But you mentioned earlier about Bernal possibly leading Team Sky at the Giro. An interview this week in The Guardian with Donald McRae, with Geraint Thomas, I should say. Donald McRae was the interviewer. Geraint Thomas hinted in that he had unfinished business at the Giro and that he might fancy going back there. That could be a kind of an opening skirmish, because... You know, there is this question about, certainly Froome is focused on a fifth Tour de France win. One or two, Geraint Thomas has a book coming out about his Tour de France win, and there are one or two things in there about just how the pecking order at Team Sky at the Tour remained very much with Chris Froome at the top of the tree until quite late on in the race. I don't think that's a great surprise that Froome was the guy who... was the only guy they were going to wait for in the event of a problem in the team time trial, even though Thomas at the time was better placed. And that on the night the air conditioning, they tripped the electricity in a hotel and could only use one air conditioning unit, and it was Froome who was given the air conditioning unit Thomas managed to sneak one in for himself. Not a huge surprise. That is, you know, it's easy to say now, well, that's, you know, that's terrible, or they should have been on a more equal footing. But remember, at the time, Chris Froome was a six-time Grand Tour winner, and Geraint Thomas had never finished in the top 10 of a Grand Tour. So I don't think that's a huge revelation. But I was quite interested to see Thomas hint that he might go back to the Giro.
Yeah, he crashed out, of course, on the stage to Blockhouse, didn't he, last year, and was well-placed up to that point. And despite, I say crashed out, he didn't actually quit the race that day because
he rode very well in the time trial a couple of days later.
He did. That was a phenomenal performance given the injuries and the pain he was feeling in his knee. You know, he called it quits shortly after that. But now we've seen him ride the way he did in the Tour de France. He could certainly go to the Giro as a leader. And just to kind of steer the conversation around to Christian Prudhomme's point about possibly banning power meters from the Tour de France next year. That was one of the key lines from the Tour de France route unveiling last week. It's interesting that the Giro just doesn't have that same issue, does it? Very few, there's very few calls for banning power meters as a result of the Giro. That strikes me that the problem isn't power meters necessarily. It's the fact that Team Sky have for several years in a row turned up at the Tour de France with everybody on their A game, with it as the absolute pinnacle peak and chief objective of their season. And I just wonder what you made of Prudhomme's comments about the possibility of banning power meters from the Tour.
First of all, Lionel, just on the point about the possibility of doing the double, or Thomas going for the Giro and then possibly turning up at the Tour as well, we shouldn't forget that next year, or in 2019, there are going to be fewer days between the two races. Last year there was an extra week because of the World Cup, and that probably was a key reason why Tom Dumoulin and Chris Froome were able to go so well in both races. Last year there were 40 days between the end of the Giro and the start of the Tour. This year they're only going to be, or next year they're only going to be 34 days. So that will make quite a big difference, I think. As regards power meters, I would be fairly open-minded about it. A few people have suggested they should just try it for a year to see what happens, see if it does make any difference, suck it and see, and you can easily discard or abort the experiment after 1 year. There were similar calls in the 1990s for the UCI to ban heart rate monitors when they first came in, because there was a perception that riders were doing what people believe riders are doing now, riding looking at their heart rate monitors, not making efforts, to not go above a threshold or whatever. Those calls sort of faded away with time, and there are probably more urgent matters for the powers that be to address. I saw Fred Grapp, the Française des Jeux coach, write on Twitter yesterday or a couple of days ago that it was ridiculous that people were talking about banning power meters when there are teams, he believes there are teams using sort of psychotropic drugs that are mind-altering drugs that are probably, well, we presume they're legal, but change people's perception of fatigue, which, you know, may be having a bigger effect than power meters. I don't know, but yeah, I think you give it a go for a year. You know, we've had this debate for years about race radios. You know, we've sort of swung one way and the other on that. There's certainly, you know, when you watch a race like the World Championships in Innsbruck a few weeks ago, where there weren't race radios and it was very exciting, you're inclined to think, well, that's worth maybe trying at the Tour de France as well.
It's also a style of riding, isn't it? There are riders who ride in a calculating way, and there have been throughout history, and it is the most efficient way to ride the Tour de France. You know, I remember Shane Sutton always saying, you know, you start the Grand Tour with a tank of petrol, and your job is to use it as efficiently as possible throughout the race. And the most efficient way to use petrol or to use energy is with a consistent effort. So that's the issue. I mean, the irony in a way is that, you know, Chris Froome and Team Sky get criticized a lot for riding to power. But if you actually look at the way that Froome has won his tours, and especially the Giro this year, he wasn't riding it by looking at his power meter, was he? He was winning it by looking at his power meter. He was winning these races with attacks at the right moments. I guess the issue is more the team riding to power. And, you know, once they have a lead, the way they can defend it. But I don't know that it would make an awful lot of difference. I think Team Sky would still turn up with a very powerful team, and they know what they're doing. You know, riders generally do know how to judge an effort. I don't think they need a little screen on their handlebars to tell them how to judge an effort. So I'm really not sure it would make an awful lot of difference.
Yeah, I actually spoke to Alex Dowsett this week, and I asked him about the possibility of banning power meters, and he made that exact point. He said when he rides a time trial, he uses the power meter just for the first 5 minutes, just to reassure himself that he's not going too hard too soon. And then after that, he rides on feel. And he said that if you take the power meters away from the riders, they are adept at riding on feel. They know they know what they're capable of doing. And he said he would be very surprised if people were, you know, looking at the screen as if playing a computer game and riding to a particular number on the screen. Lots of riders will have different opinions on it, I'm sure. I'm minded to think that rather than try it just for a year, why not rewrite the rules so that race organisers are given freedom to choose, and then we'll see what happens. You know, so some race organisers who feel very strongly about this might say, well, yeah, this year we're gonna ban power meters in the race and see what happens. I mean, that way you would find out which riders fancy it, don't fancy it, what the teams do, and then you would see whether or not the style of racing actually is altered at all. And rather than having a sort of blanket ban, I think one of the problems with the World Tour schedule, particularly when it comes to the stage races, is that everything is kind of much of a muchness. We have this diet of kind of week-long stage races, the three Grand Tours, and, you know, more week-long stage races. So if some of them were power meter free, it may be a different flavour of racing every now and again. Who knows?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. We have a question this week from Daniel Navarette. This is a fascinating question. We put this to Science and Sports expert Ben Samuels. Hey guys, love the podcast, long time listener, first time emailer, says Daniel. I have a question for Science and Sport. 2 years ago, I donated a kidney to my dad. Long story. My question is, should I be fueling in any particular way due to this? I've been riding a lot recently, preparing for a couple of events. It would be useful to know if I should be doing anything different to my normal approach to eating when on the bike. My main fuel on the bike at the minute is jelly babies and sports drink. Many thanks, Dan.
The fueling requirements for those exercising with a single kidney wouldn't necessarily differ. So during those long endurance efforts, you'd still be looking to fuel with 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And that can come from a range of sources depending on your personal preference. Things such as gels, energy bars, sports drinks, jelly sweets, or even bananas. The key being to deliver that carbohydrate to fuel performance. Now, in relation to hydration, a single kidney is perfectly capable of regulating both fluid and electrolyte balance. Of course, you'd still be at the same risk as others in the form of hypernatremia or hyperhydration, but if you understand your hydration needs during exercise, potentially through weighing yourself before and after a ride to know fluid losses, there's no reason that you can't go into that ride with a fluid strategy to maintain hydration status.
A really fascinating question there from Daniel Navarette, and I hope Ben Samuel's answer was helpful. Thanks again to Science and Sport for sponsoring us, and you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at the website scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Might have to break into my stash of Science and Sport gels because I'm speaking on Halloween, and I've just had a message from my wife in the house saying that they run out of sweets to give the guy, well, we call them geysers, trick and treaters. How do you think these kids dressed up in fancy costumes would respond to Science and Sport energy gels?
Depends what their bedtime is.
Maybe that'd be irresponsible.
Anything to send them packing. By the way, on Halloween, by far the scariest thing I saw this Halloween was Team Sky's attempt at the crossbar challenge.
Oh, my word.
Lionel, maybe you can explain what the crossbar challenge is for those who haven't, who were fortunate enough not to have seen the video.
So this is a regular feature on a Sky program called Soccer AM, where they usually go to a professional football club and the players take turns to shoot from just outside the penalty area. And the goal is to try and hit the crossbar, which is quite a difficult thing to do. It requires a bit of distant judgment and ball striking. And Team Sky had a go at this. They were up at St George's Park, the base where the England team train, and they had a go at this. And the yellow jersey for crossbar challenge has to go to Chris Lawless. He was actually pretty good, hit the crossbar and had a very decent technique. But some of the others, my word, Egan Bernal's toe punt has to be seen to be believed. And Chris Froome, well, I imagine he was picked last for any kind of football. Well, he would be picked last on that evidence for any kind of football, you know, game.
Stick to cycling, mate.
It made you feel better about your cycling, didn't it?
It certainly did. I think, even though Chris Froome would put hours into me cycling, if it was a cycling football duathlon,
it'd be a close
mashup.
Oh dear.
Just briefly on Team Sky, it didn't make your news roundup, Lionel. I know the bar is very high for news stories in the news roundup, but a bit of contract news. Team Sky, Owen Doole has got a new contract. He's been there for 2 years. He was one of the intake from a couple of years ago of young British riders. John Dibben, we understand, has not been offered a new contract at Team Sky after 2 years. Had a good first season, won the time trial Tour of California, didn't he? But hasn't done too much this year. David Lopez, the Spanish veteran as well, he has not been offered a new contract at Sky. So he
and not a good time, is it, to be out of contract this winter? Well, if it were a game of musical chairs, a good number of the chairs have been taken away and quite a few people are sort of scrambling to get something very late on. This probably leads us into, we could maybe talk about Andy Fenn and the Aqua Blue Sport team, who, of course, folded just before the Tour of Britain, stopped in their tracks, really. They didn't just announce that they were... Well, they first of all announced they'd be ending at the end of the season, and then it was announced that they were ending with immediate effect. And some riders have been luckier than others. Larry Warbass has got a contract at AG2R, for example. Adam Blythe is going back to Lotto Soudal, that is, where he started his career. But others have not been so fortunate. And, we had Rick Delaney, the team's owner, on the podcast during the Vuelta when the team collapsed, and he was putting his side of the story, and he made some bold promises. He said that the riders would all get paid up to the end of the year, and that has been happening because the UCI have been paying the riders from the bond that the team lodged. I gather that the most recent payment they received is the September salary. We are now right at the very end of October. It's November tomorrow. So it remains to be seen exactly what is going to happen with the October, November and December salaries. Riders will no doubt be nervous about that. And the other thing that Delaney pledged was that any riders who had a contract with Aqua Blue for 2019 who were unable to find a team for the year, he would ensure that they got paid. Now, my interpretation of that was that effectively that would free up a rider to go to another team and say, look, I can ride for you effectively for free because my salary is being covered by Aqua Blue Sport / Rick Delaney. That was certainly my interpretation of it. I've been trying to get hold of Rick Delaney this week to just clarify what is going on there, because I gather a couple of riders, Connor Dunn and Mark Christian, had contracts for 2019 with the team, and so are they're very much in limbo at the moment. There may be others. I'm not entirely sure if anyone else is in that particular situation, but I've not been able to get hold of Rick Delaney. I've been told today that he's in Australia, but we do know that the Aqua Blue Sport e-commerce website, which was the whole kind of machinery behind the team, the idea was that the sales of stuff on that website would fund the team. This was the business model that they'd set up. Well, that website is no longer online, so everything has sort of disappeared. So we're quite keen to speak to Rick Delaney and find out exactly whether he's going to make good on the pledge that he made. So we will keep trying.
Andy Fenn is one of these riders in limbo. He's 28 now, so really should be in the peak years of his career. He's ridden for some big teams, Quick Step, Team Sky, had very good results as a young rider, and searching now for a team.
Yeah, I've been looking, obviously, since the team announced they were stopping. To be honest, I'm struggling. It's pretty tough right now. There's a lot of guys, you know, in the same position as myself. There's guys out there offering themselves for free now. And to be honest, I think you get what you pay for, and I think I do have a value to a team. But yeah, I expect something in return. So I think it just sets a bad precedent for yourself, really, if you offer yourself for free. And you know, the next time around, they're going to say, yeah, well, you were free last year, so why can't I be free this year? Or, you know, we know it's a tough market for the riders. You know, it's definitely a buyer's market. And
where are you looking? I mean, the scene in Britain isn't great, but are you concentrating your efforts on, you know, I know you live in Belgium now. Are you looking there? Are you looking throughout Europe, really?
I mean, you know, I've been in World Tour teams and Pro Conti teams for the last 7 years, so I would like to stay there. I definitely think I, you know, got the experience to stay there, for one. But yeah, with the teams going down to 22 riders also, or, you know, some teams taking only 22 guys, there's already cuts anyway in teams. So, definitely the big professional teams are definitely hard pickings to get a spot.
What do you tell teams, you know, do you have direct conversations yourself with teams, or is it mainly through your agent?
A bit of both, I think, you know. I think agents are definitely struggling right now as well. I think every agent's got guys that they're trying to place. So, they're just trying to get people where they can. I'm obviously calling people myself. I think it's, you know, probably even pissed off one or two managers, calling them too much, or, you know, pestering them a bit. But, I don't know what they expect, really, you know. Sort of going to go down that fight, so to speak. So,
what do you tell them? What's your, you know, what you've got that experience, of course. You've won races in the past. You know, you've got a lot of experience in the sort of classic races. What do you tell them if you get the chance to speak to somebody and, you know, try to get them interested in signing you?
I think part of it is finding where their team's trying to go. You know, everyone sort of have a role they could play in the team. Yeah, myself, obviously, the classic races, the flat races, you know, working with sprinters. I've, you know, worked with so many sprinters in the past. You know, if there's a team going down that route, obviously, trying to, you know, find a team which benefits both of you. You know, just because you're an ex-rider with a lot of experience, there's no point going to a team that doesn't fit with your goals as well. So, there is obviously teams out there. Obviously, a lot of teams are going GC orientated, climber orientated, but you know, I definitely do have a purpose. You know, looking after those guys on the flat or in the early part of the races and doing a job for them. So, yeah, just seeing what teams are available and if the relationship between the two of us could be good, really.
We had Rick Delaney on the podcast talking about what happened and making a pledge, really, to carry on paying people to honour the commitments that he'd made. I mean, has he done that? Yeah. We've heard one or two rumours that, you know, people haven't been paid and that contracts haven't been honoured.
Yeah, I mean, it was dragging on for a long time. It was basically yesterday we actually received our September salary, so that's good news on that front. It was a month late because they've decided to take it to UCI for the bank guarantee, which is in place for, to be used, or there is there for a reason. But it has taken a month to resolve. We know December salary is still a question mark. That's come from UCI. I spoke to them myself. It's still in November, so there's always time to get December sorted, I guess, for all of us. But
because you were due 3 months. I mean, the UCI guarantee is 3 months, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it only has to be set up for 3 months. So, you know, him saying, yeah, we'll pay the four or you will get it till the end of December. Okay, you know, he said it on your podcast not long after the team folded. So, yeah, we just hope he honours that, really.
Well, we're trying to get hold of him as well, just to ask, because we've heard from one or two riders. I mean, that's good news that you've got the September salary at least. What do you have you put a time limit on things? Because when I spoke to you before, you said that you couldn't see yourself, you know, taking a year out or anything like that and coming back. Have you set a time limit, and have you thought, you know, about what would happen if you didn't get a team?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do want to continue to be a bike rider first and foremost. It's, you know, I'm kind of that age now, 28. It's not old in the sport at all. Sort of, you know, every athlete sort of wants to go on their own terms. And right now, I definitely wouldn't be doing that. Like physically this year, actually, I was as good as I've ever been. You know, power files can show that, you know, results speak for themselves. So looked into staying in the sport. I think there was a time where, you know, I thought, well, if I don't get a team, maybe I just walk away completely. But I think that would be a waste, actually, giving something back. You know, working for another team, you know, as a member of staff or, you know, a directing role or coaching role is something that I am pursuing now. I think I have to, really. Come January, yeah, but I'll need to have some sort of income. You know, I'm not 21 or 22 anymore where I could take that year. Yeah, probably get a team at the end of next year anyway, because team numbers are going back up. So I think for the majority of guys who do stick it out for another year, or they will get picked up at the end of the year or even during the year if some of these teams have, you know, injuries or illnesses.
How do you motivate yourself to train at the moment? I mean, it's, you know, I guess probably getting back into training about now. What do you, how difficult is that?
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, yeah, we were made aware if the team was stopping end of August, wasn't it, I think. So, yeah, I mean, to not race from then is very early. So, you know, you've still got to try and stay in some sort of shape. But at the same time, you do need a bit of an off-season as well, because if you were to start it all again next year, you do need some sort of break anyway. You know, we kind of have to think, well, which side do I focus on? If no one's showing the interest or, you know, believes in me as a bike rider, then it's difficult to decide to carry on till, you know, December 31st and be like, right, well, okay, that's it.
So that was Andy Fenn, obviously in a very difficult situation, searching for a team. Talked about how hard it is to motivate yourself to carry on training. You know, now is about the time people start to resume training, especially if, like him, you are targeting some of the sort of classic races in the early part of the season. So difficult times for a lot of riders at the moment. I said at the start of the show we were going to do a little look at track racing. I mean, something that's caught my eye and has been a trend over the last couple of years, just been how quick some of the track sprinters are going. And in the World Cup at the weekend there in Canada, looking at the qualification for the men's sprint, for example, 24 riders were inside 10 seconds for the 200-metre sprint. There was a time, I mean, not so long ago, when it was quite unusual to go under 10 seconds. But now it's, you know, riders are going 9.5. Matthew Gleitzer was the quickest qualifier, 9.517. It really is astonishing. And, you know, this has happened largely because they're using bigger gears. And what fascinates me about that is just that, you know, despite the sport having been around for so long, and this applies to road as well, there can still be sort of step changes in progress. We can still be quite radical kind of innovations in equipment, in training, preparation, nutrition, in all these areas that can really produce quite startling results, I think. And that's fascinating. You wonder what else is out there, or whether it's just a fashion and, you know, the athletes are just better. In order to try and understand that a bit more, I spoke to Chris Hoy about it, but I also spoke to Callum Skinner. Now, Callum Skinner won a gold medal and a silver medal at the Rio Olympic Games in the team sprint and the sprint. He is taking a break from competition at the moment, found it difficult to maintain the standards required, really, after the Olympics. To motivation as well, I think, was an issue post-Olympics. So he's taking a break at the moment, but he's got very involved in sports politics. He's been very outspoken about WADA. He sits on various athlete committees with various bodies now, and is standing for the Athlete Commission at the BOA now as well. So very, very active in that and has been, as I say, very vocal. So I want to speak to him about, you know, his reasons for getting involved in that and where he sees that path leading.
I've always tried to use my kind of profile, but it was always quite limited to, I guess, kind of just mouthing off on Twitter, and I thought I'd try and make something a bit more productive out of it. I can't really think of any kind of IOC members or the people in power that are on there to even see that message, and then when it's up there, it kind of can get misconstrued, and it's obviously limited to a number of characters. So I thought I'd kind of try and get a bit more involved in kind of giving official feedback. I've talked about to you before about the first time that I thought that I had a voice that people would be interested in listening to was when I tweeted about Brexit, and that went a bit viral. And I guess having this break and having a bit more time to think on my hands, and I got into the whole anti-doping thing quite heavily, I'm keen to move into kind of athlete welfare and making the kind of UK sports system sustainable over a long period of time. But I guess that while these opportunities are kind of popping up, I'm just keen to get stuck in, and I'm keen to see some kind of progression on that as well. I'd like to see there be a greater athlete voice, and it not just be a recommendation that we put forward, but the athletes actually have some kind of like power, whether it's on the boards or some kind of power in decision making. Because I think quite often, you know, no one tends to know the sport better than the people who are on the pitch or on the track, I think.
It's interesting because I suppose when you talk about, you know, politics and sports politics, the way to get ahead is to, you know, is to work your way up from the inside rather than to rattle the cage and complain about things.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are you driven by, you know, is a sports politics career something you'd be interested in? Are you driven more by, you know, raising awareness, bringing people's attention to some of these things that you feel are not right at the moment?
I guess I'm still trying to consider what's like an appropriate strategy. I think I can be quite hot-headed and in the moment when it comes to decisions that I really don't agree with. And, you know, you're right. It's like, you know, you can make all the noise you want, but does that progress you into positions where you can have influence? Possibly not. And I think that's a line that a lot of people walk in sports politics every day. You know, it's kind of a bit of a balance between what they think would be best and you know, what kind of maintains their position in there, which is quite unfortunate. I think it should be a bit more open and a bit more free. And I think that's why it's been so disappointing to hear that, you know, the way that Becky Scott was treated at the WADA meeting. It's really disappointing to see that there was IOC members apparently there kind of belittling her voice, you know, basically just trying to put her back in her place and say that you're an athlete, shut up and we'll get on with this.
You care about these things and you're very eloquent on them. Do you, you know, would you want to be maybe in the future in a position of some, you know, where you're able to influence these things more directly?
Yeah, I'm definitely still of the opinion that it's better to be within the system and try and change it than it is to be without the out with the system and making a lot of noise. But yeah, no, I'd say my kind of major aspiration is to try and get more athlete representation at board level. I think that athletes, especially in the UK sports system, have become massive stakeholders, you know, far larger than they ever used to be. There's a huge proportion of a national governing body budget going towards them, and you know, everyone knows with the kind of turbulent times of British cycling, you know, how things can go wrong if issues that are brought up by the athletes aren't dealt with. I think the other problem is that it's quite easy to say, okay, I'll aspire to be the head of any kind of world governing body or anything like that, but I think the processes by which you get elected to that probably work against my character a little bit. It seems definitely more like a kind of political game, and I think that's mainly because, you know, the people who represent us in sport aren't really held to any account. I can't really list off. I mean, I'm quite involved, but I can barely list off a lot of the people who are involved. You know, at the IOC level that are representing us, there's just not really much accountability, which is why I think, you know, even if I don't get myself into that room making decisions, if I make more noise, make, you know, athletes more aware of who's making the decisions that they possibly disagree with, and that's going to be a good step forward.
So that was Callum Skinner on his sports politics career, if you can call it that. He's still young, Callum, and hopefully he can come back as an athlete, but, you know, I think longer term, he definitely could have a future in sports politics, and seems to be very much driven by, you know, the ideas that he has, the thoughts he has about some of the things that are right and wrong about the way that sport is run at the moment. And on the sprinting side, I asked him about that as well, because that clearly is a factor in him taking a break. The trend for bigger gears is putting different demands on the riders, and requires maybe a different, slightly different physiology. So I spoke to him about that, and then we'll hear from Chris Hoy, who of course retired in 2013, and he's been watching this from afar, this trend, and had some interesting thoughts on it too. So here's Callum Skinner and then Chris Hoy.
To go to Tokyo is the goal of the entire team. But I'd say I probably just kind of struggled in the last, especially since Commonwealth Games, or before that as well, to just try and get back up to that Olympic standard. I think we performed exceptionally well at the Olympic Games, and to try and carry that on became really difficult. And it became quite evident that, you know, I'm probably not going to be one of the more consistent performers when it comes to that exceptional grade of performance, I guess. So it's about kind of taking a step back. You know, within our team, we lost our S&C coach and our physiologist, and they were two of the people that probably relied on the most in our team. So to see them go and, you know, form new relationships with the people that filled that role kind of took a little while. And then also, I feel like the sport is starting to shift a little bit. The physiology of the sport is starting to shift. I think where the gears are getting so humongous, that the days of seeing kind of Teo Boss, you know, Kevin Sulu, Chris Hoy, you know, the slightly taller guys that aren't built like Robert Fosterman, are kind of maybe starting to fade a little bit. It's becoming a bit more like bodybuilders on bikes a little bit. And I know that all sports kind of go through that transitional period and that kind of continual evolution, I guess. So yeah, I guess there's just a few things to consider. I've kind of taken this time out to kind of find my motivation again and find what I want to do going forward, to try out some new things as well. I've been kind of training with Jason at his country house and all this kind of stuff, and training with the kayakers down in London for a little bit, like local gym as well. So it's just about kind of getting a change of scene. I think I'd spent the last 10 plus years of my life at Manchester Velodrome pursuing an Olympic gold medal, and to do the exact same again, I guess it just didn't seem as motivating the second time around.
I think if you're realistic about it, sport changes constantly, so you don't notice it when you're in the sport and you're constantly chasing your own goals and other riders that you're trying to beat. But it's when you step back from it and then you look at it and you realise, yeah, things do move on, and sometimes you have to do that.
In practical terms, what size of gears are they using now? I mean, compared to your day?
It's almost, without joking, it's almost the biggest gears they can get hold of. So, you know, using 11 sprockets in the back, using some of the riders are using like 60 plus tooths on the front and 11 in the back. And you think, how on earth do they get that going? But if you look at the efficiency of it, and I tried it, the last race I ever did in the sprint, the last World Cup, I think it was in Kazakhstan, and the week before, I was struggling, and I was really training through the World Cup, so I wasn't freshening up for it, so I was tired, and we were doing a flying speed session, and it was a normal race gears, which would have been sort of 52.14, about 100 inch, maybe 53.14, 102, and I'd done three efforts, and I was like maybe doing a 5.2, 5.3 with spoke wheels on, you know, sort of training wheels on, and I was like, this is going nowhere. You know, I was like, I'm just going to pack up. There's no point in training when the times are this bad, and I'm just not. There's nothing in the tank. And Jan said, well, why don't you stick on a 12 in the back and just see what happens? You know, you've got nothing to lose. And I thought, well, what's the point? You know, I was like, oh, all right, I'll, you know, just to have done the session, to finish the session off. Okay, I'll go up and do it on a massive gear and just, you know, do it as a strength session. And I got up and just rolled round, did the flying 100 effort, felt dreadful, came in. And he was sort of shaking his head, and I thought, oh God, it's like a 5.5 or 5.6, and he said, look at the stopwatch, and it was something like a tenth and a half quicker than I'd gone at my best time on my previous race gear, just out of nowhere, like over 100 metres. So you think over 200 metres, you could be knocking two or three tenths off your time just by changing that gear. And I think at that point I was thinking, this is incredible. You know, this is clearly the way everyone's starting to go now, using bigger gears. It has repercussions on the tactics you use. It, you don't see guys going, backing off, going again. There's just this one big rush now in the sprint and in the Kieran. And with the Kieran being over three laps now, that makes the tactics more interesting, because you can't sort of, you know, have more than one bite at the apple. But it is amazing how the gears have changed, the times are doing, and it's, and how the riders, 27 guys went under 10 seconds at the World Cup in Paris, you know.
But is it a positive development in the sense that it will favour, you know, presumably bigger, stronger athletes over peddlers, over, you know, I mean, you mentioned that the way it's changed the tactics in sprinting, and one of the things people love about sprinting is the cat and mouse, the, you know, that element of it. Is it, you know, is it going to change how it looks?
Yes and no. I think you won't see so many riders like Aziz Olawang, even someone like Ross Edgar, the smaller riders who, you know, have relied on pedaling and you know, efficiency. But at the same time, you're still pedaling a bike. You still have to be efficient. There's still pedaling efficiency at the lower cadences. But you do see, if you look at the podiums now, it does tend to be 6 foot plus guys, 90 kilos plus, big strong boys who are just, who, you know, have the torque and the power, you know, kicking out 2,500 watts plus. But then you look at Jack Carlin, you know, silver medal at the Worlds and the Commonwealth Games. I think he's high 70s, maybe 77 kilos. He's not that tall, and he's dealing with the big gear ratios fine. So, in terms of tactics, in terms of how it looks racing, I disagree with the old codgers like myself who complain about, you know, say the old days were better. I think what you're seeing are guys going 9-9 in match sprints. The speed's higher. The tactics are still just as important, if not more important, because you've only got one choice. So tactics are hugely important. You might not get quite as much in terms of physical contact, elbow-to-elbow stuff, but the racing's still super close, super exciting. And to me, watching Laverson and Glatzer going to three rides at the World Cup at the weekend, I think it's the third time he's gone three rides in the final. And there's nothing in it. It's great to watch. And yeah, I would say the racing is as exciting as it's ever been. The Kieran, potentially, it's changed because it's now three laps instead of two and a half laps. The peak speed isn't quite what it used to be. It used to be that guys could go flat out for two and a half laps and hold it. They're not doing that now. But I genuinely believe that the evolution of the event will happen, that it'll just take one guy, a Matt Glatzer, for example, or someone like that, will lead out from the front in a final, take the front. Everyone will line him up thinking he's going to die off, and he'll hang on and do the three laps on his own, and then it'll become the new thing and people will train for that.
Who ever heard of winning a Kieran from the front like that, eh?
I know, it never worked. It's a ridiculous idea.
So that was Chris Hoy there. Interesting that Callum Skinner doesn't really like this trend for bigger gears and, as he put it, bodybuilders on bikes, whereas I think Chris Hoy is very conscious of not being seen as a sort of old fogey, a bit like what you were saying earlier, Lionel, about the controversial Lance Armstrong. I think he's trying very hard not to look like somebody who says it was better in my day. So, but, you know, quite open to the evolution of his sport.
Yeah, I think we see it, don't we, the increasing specialization in all disciplines of cycling. You know, body shapes are getting more extreme, and one of the things about the track sprinting is that you could have a Jason Kenny type figure against a sort of a Chris Hoy or a you know, some of the, you know, the really, really big guys can go up against somebody like a Wang, who is, you know, small and nimble. I think the trend for bigger gears, it's a great phrase, bodybuilders on bikes. If you reduce an event, a real blue ribbon event like the track sprint, down to just one physical type, it will inevitably lose something over time. So yeah, it's an interesting trend to keep an eye on. And Callum Skinner is an interesting guy. Remember when the Fancy Bears hack leaked information about therapeutic use exemptions that athletes had applied for and been granted, and he took the decision to release all of his medical records publicly, just to demonstrate that his asthma was a historic thing, and the fact that he is taking the initiative to challenge WADA, it's an interesting development, and perhaps he, you know, sports politics is a career in its own right, and you don't have to look too far in most sports to think that a lot of sports could do with some
representation.
Yeah.
You know, and this came up with the CPA election recently, and how a lot of the riders didn't feel like they had a voice or a representative. And there aren't many riders perhaps who are able to stand up and speak so eloquently. And I've been very impressed by Callum Skinner since Rio and since he's had that platform. And it all started for him with the Leave campaign using his image around, it was just after Brexit vote. The Brexit referendum, and the Leave campaign used his image in some publicity, and he objected to it publicly, and that got a big response, and he became quite emboldened on the back of that to actually, he realised that people were going to listen to what he had to say, and he's been very, he's spoken a lot about LGBT rights as well. He has, family experience of in that area. His brother and his father are both gay, and he's been very, very vocal on those issues, and also on lots of issues concerned with sport, obviously. And I think there are very few athletes who've been prepared to really put themselves out there and be spokespeople and risk a bit of unpopularity, because he's certainly been not afraid to attack and criticise very heavily those that run sport, at WADA, at the IOC, and even at British Cycling as well. So, good on him for that. Well, shall we wrap things up for this week, fellas? Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Taps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Paul Scoynes.